Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. For many people, if they think about the concept of arrangements in music at all, they often think of it in the folk music world, in which an arranger takes a piece of music from the folk canon and arranges it for a particular instrument. But arrangements have an important place in the classical music universe as well.
Each month, we speak with contributor Robert Cohen about the work of a touring classical musician. It's a feature called On That Note, and for October, Robert talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about why arrangements are so important. Important in classical music.
Actually, of course, you can go way back to, you know, Beethoven, who wrote variations on a Mozart theme, for instance. So in a way, that's a kind of arrangement. Of course, it's their own creation. But in a way, of course, it's not as often done as it is in the pop world, or, you know, taking somebody's song and rearranging it, or making new orchestrations for, you know, a simple melody. I mean, I always interested, for instance, because I love to listen to, you know, the old greats, Ella Fitzgerald and Doris Day and, you know, those kind of Frank Sinatra. And sometimes I'm just browsing through recordings, and some of them really appeal to me so much more. And it's not just because it's slightly differently sung or it's a different tempo, but the whole orchestration, the whole arrangement of the group, musically creates such a different atmosphere. And then I get so caught up in listening to that particular version that when I listen to Frank Sinatra sing the same song and it wasn't a Nelson Riddle arrangement or something, I kind of think, well, this is okay, but I really love the other one, you know. So it brings to my attention how important the arranger really is in filling the whole space, making the musical experience something quite wonderful.
And it's almost, they're not composing exactly, but in a way they are, because they're taking something and they're creating something new from those pieces. And so a different arranger might arrange those pieces in a different way. So, you know, you're hearing that person's creative input when you hear that arrangement. And like you mentioned Nelson Riddle, I have all of those Ella Fitzgerald songbooks that they recorded in the 1950s, and they are so distinctive. You know, within two notes, that it's a Nelson Riddle version of this, you know, an arrangement of whatever the song standard is. And they are as distinctive in some ways as composers.
Yeah, and if you think about it, the whole of the kind of Hollywood sound from the 1940s onwards was created by, you know, a group of musician, arranger, composers who did the soundtracks for all of those movies and created that luscious, you know, Hollywood sound that you know, kind of marked that entire era and made it so recognizable that you were watching a Hollywood movie, because there was something sensational about the way the music was written and arranged. And they had all those amazing composers, including classical composers, writing for movies. And the arrangers were the people who were creating the kind of identity, in a way. I mean, I remember you mentioning about Duke Ellington and how Billy Strayhorn, his arranger, I mean, who was not acknowledged at all by Duke Ellington publicly. And, you know, he wrote, I think, Take the A Train, for instance, and he composed all sorts of things. But you could attribute a lot of Duke Ellington's kind of type of sound to Billy Strayhorn, in a way. I mean, he created... an identity for the group.
Exactly. And you mentioned Hollywood, of course. I was thinking of Korngold and a few other. All of those folks from the 40s and 50s had classical background. They were all classically trained composers and musicians. And so that fed into that sound in a way that would have been different if they had a different kind of musical background.
Yeah, and you know, it reminds me of that story of Horowitz, the great pianist, who decided that, you know, as a classical musician, decided that he was going to try to take tea for two and make an arrangement. And he took his arrangement, so the story goes, to Art Tatum, you know, possibly the greatest jazz pianist who's ever lived. And he played it to Art Tatum and then said, well, you know, now will you play me your T for two? And Art Tatum apparently then completely blew him away with his own arrangement, so to speak. And then Horowitz said, well, could I see the music for that? Could I? Because I really love to be able to play that, you know, that version. And Art Tatum said, well, I just made it up just now. So which was the difference between a classical musician trying to arrange a piece and a jazz musician playing it in that way. I mean, I think that, you know, that's really, it is extraordinary how the jazz sort of understanding of how things, the freedom in it, allows a jazz musician to do what most of us classical musicians really, really struggle to. We're so tied down with analyzing every detail of the score, of the way the composer, we think the composer wants it to play, to be played, that we certainly don't train ourselves to change the notes, change the styles, change the whole feeling of the music, because we just feel like it. I mean, we don't do that really as classical. In fact, you know, I was recently asked to play the cello at a party with some singers who wanted to do some opera arias, and they said, "Oh, could you, you know, play along with us?" They sent me the music for these famous opera arias, and I was thought, well, how am I going to bring that fantastic opera orchestra down to just me? How can I make this work in any way at all? And so I started to battle how to choose the notes that I felt might be, you know, give some meaning to the music as a background, as an arrangement. And I realized that, you know, I'm really hopeless at this. It's certainly not what I should be doing. I need to go to do some serious training if I was going to learn how to arrange for different instrumentation, or, you know, I'd have to go back to school. I really would.
So you're not going to be a Billy Strayhorn to somebody's Duke Ellington?
I'm sadly not. I mean, what I can, I have sort of learned to improvise a melody, because a single line I can sort of take a melody that I know and kind of work around that in a way, but to actually organize all the background, all the harmonic things, and to twist and turn and all of that sort of thing, that is such an incredible talent. And actually thinking about those people in Hollywood at the time, one of those people was Andre Previn. He was arranging, composing music for the films and so on, and of course became a very, very famous classical musician, you know, as conductor of major orchestras and so on, and as a fantastic jazz pianist. And it's another example of somebody who trained in that way, who brought this sort of real sense of how to move music around a melody that can make it really shine.
You know, I find it fascinating that classical music lost that ability, because when you think of the Baroque and you think of what was expected of not just the soloists, but the people who were playing the figured bass and who were expected on the harpsichord to kind of improvise around that, improvisation and sort of arranging on the fly was not something that they were unfamiliar with. In fact, it was expected. And yet that has changed over the last few hundred years, where, like you were saying, you're not trained to do that. You're not expected to do that in a way that, say, Telemann was.
Now, you're so right about this, because now that, you know, the kind of, there's been a much deeper exploration into how Baroque music was played, and how, you know, the thoughts of how that might have happened and what could have happened in that, and how it sounded and what people used to do, and all the research that's gone into that. And now we know that it was very simply the case that even when you were playing a cello Bach suite a suite by Bach, that each section which has a repeat in it, and the second time you would play it really differently with different different ornamentation, maybe different emphasis on different things, but it was expected to do that. And as you say, music with figured bass, that means, you know, just a bass line with the numbers of the, which explain the chords, and you were expected to work with that. You weren't given all the notes. And so we moved so far from that.
Right. I was going to say that's kind of like the equivalent of chord charts in jazz or rock.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. You know, the guitarist is given the chord chart, and it's up to you to figure out how you fit in to all of that. And it's funny how classical music became more codified, and that freedom and expectation of improvisation went away somehow.
And even actually the classical musicians who also play jazz, I must say that when they play classical music, they tend to be very straight with it. And perhaps some that aren't get criticized for not being straight. So there's still an attitude, I have to say. And of course, there's some appropriate music. I mean, I don't think if you played Dvorak cello concerto that it's appropriate to start inventing things as you go along. I feel that the music has been so beautifully crafted in a certain way that you don't want to stretch it out of its own architecture. Whereas perhaps with the Baroque music, which is simpler, it gives you space for that kind of thing, then maybe that is okay.
Yeah. I was also thinking that one of the ways that classical music kept some of that improvisatory quality is in the cadenza.
Oh, yes, exactly. And, you know, that's funny because I have to occasionally write a cadenza for a concerto. Well, I feel like I want to sometimes.
We probably should explain what a cadenza is for those who don't know.
Yeah, well, it's like a free improvisation of in a section of music. So, for instance, you play the written music for almost like 5 minutes, let's say, for example, and then it's written that the soloist should improvise, should play a cadenza, that meaning that they should take ideas from everything that they've just played, but be alone and now put those ideas into something in a way to show off, really, to show how brilliant you are as an instrumentalist and your musical ideas. And just stretch things like a jazz musician and then bring it back to a point where you would finish your movement with the orchestra. So that cadenza could be completely free improvisation, or as is more traditional, it would be that you write some cadenza. And there have been famous composers who have written cadenzas for other people's music, or instrumentalists who've written their own cadenzas. So they're not improvising it, but now actually it has been composed as a kind of written down improvisation, let me put it that way.
Yeah, and it's almost like you get a chance to take a solo in a different way, more like the way a jazz musician would take a solo within the architecture of the piece.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. That sort of thing is not so difficult for me, actually. I have to say I don't struggle with that so much because I'm actually using somebody else, the composer's material, and I'm making a new puzzle really with it, and taking a few experiments in different directions.
Well, Robert, we're looking forward to talking to you more about what you do so well, which is perform music around the world. I am so looking forward to talking to you next month. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Pleasure, as always, Bonnie. Look forward to speaking to you soon.
Robert Cohen is a world-renowned professional cellist. He joins us each month to talk about the work of a touring classical musician in a segment called On That Note. You can hear previous interviews at wuwm.com.